From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Picture the middle class in 1960s America, if you can. And the picture looks like a different country. More equal, more secure, more hopeful. Not anymore. With inequality rising and new challenges pushing in, today's middle class is living with more risk, less income growth, and a much less secure footing. Tonight on Point, the vanishing middle class society and what it means for American democracy. But first tonight, we turn to Washington, where President Bush today met with South Korean President No Moo Hyun. The meeting was in part an attempt to iron out differences in approach to North Korea. Joining me now from the Capitol is Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Glenn, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you.
Obvious differences between the approach of these two men to North Korea, we're told. What is the difference between South Korea and Washington's approach, and what middle ground did they find today, if any?
Well, I think what they were trying to do was emphasize that they both want North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. That seems like a kind of an obvious goal, but it's the one goal that all these parties to these disarmament talks agree on. Essentially, the United States has tended to be much more impatient, much more eager to try to bring sanctions and other tough actions against North Korea if they don't return to the talks. South Korea, which the capital of South Korea, Seoul, is just 30 miles from the North Korean border and would be annihilated in any kind of major conflict. South Korea doesn't want to do that. They would like to take a softer approach, an approach that would involve many more economic inducements to convince North Korea that its nuclear weapons are not a way for it to become a viable member of the international community.
Those two approaches sound fairly far apart. Was there middle ground today other than this broad goal of getting rid of nuclear weapons in the North?
Well, I don't believe, from what I understand, that there was any broad, detailed discussion as to what they were how they would accomplish this. I mean, it's not often dealt like that at the presidential level. The middle ground is we agree they should give up the weapons, in essence, and it's been the position for the last 2 years. I think today the South Koreans in particular were going out of their way to make this a very successful meeting. In the past, they have tended to come by and say the U.S. has to be more flexible. From what I understand, that was not really what they said today. They were looking for areas of agreement with the Americans and to emphasize they were willing to be tough and if necessary, but I don't think they feel that point has come yet.
Why the new tone from Seoul?
Well, the U.S.-South Korean relationship is a big domestic issue back in South Korea. Mm. And the opposition to President No always says he's messed up the great relationship we used to have with the United States. And, in fact, he ran on an anti-American platform. So he's always eager when he comes out here to show that, yes, he can handle the alliance just as well as the other party.
And what about his vision of the future of North and South Korea? There's been talk that the South imagines a kind of slow merger with the North that over many years would absorb the North and thereby do away with the problem. Does that seem to be what he's leaning toward, what he's looking toward?
Well, I mean, I think that's a position of the South Korean government that eventually that would happen. There is, in fact, even a minister, unification minister, who focuses on the questions of unification. But I don't think anyone practically thinks that's going to be happening anytime soon. But they try their best to, they have economic enterprise zones in North Korea. They mm-hmm. pump a lot of money there. They have close economic links. I mean, part of the problem with the issue for the Americans is that they often say that all North Korea does is isolate itself with its behavior. But actually, ever since this crisis erupted nearly 3 years ago, China has boosted trade. It's almost tripled trade. South Korea has increased trade. The Economic Union has put a trade mission there in the capital city of North Korea. So the suggestion that somehow North Korea has been isolating itself has not been borne out by the facts on the ground.
And finally, Glenn, a report this week that Vice President Dick Cheney continues to take a very hard line on North Korea, wanting to show a very tough face on the part of the United States. Is there any sign that Washington may be opening up a softer face, different channels to Pyongyang, or is it still all tough?
Well, you know, the hardest policy for this administration has always been North Korea. There have been sharp divisions between the Pentagon and the State Department in particular. Secretary Rice tends to be more of a hardliner than Secretary Powell had been. And so I think that has narrowed some of the differences within the U.S. government. But she has constantly emphasized a diplomatic approach. And in fact, when a DOD official, an unnamed one, earlier this week said that the Americans were about ready to give up on that, she rather sharply put that person down and in their place, and Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld immediately rushed out and said he agreed completely with Secretary Rice. So I think she certainly has an upper hand in the way this is being handled at the moment.
Tough line goes right ahead. Glenn Kessler, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Glenn Kessler, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined me from Washington. We are talking tonight about the shrinking status and security of the middle class in America and what it portends for life and democracy in this country. Politicians in both parties invoke the middle class, claiming to speak for the heart of the country. But today's middle class is running out of steam and maybe out of options. Between 1973 and 2003, even as wives poured into the workforce for second incomes, middle class household income rose just 22%. While the income of the top 1% of Americans doubled, that's 200%, and the top 0.1% tripled, that's 300%. Government and employment-based benefits have gone down. Economic risk and expenses, child care, college tuition, housing have soared up. Money still talks in Washington, but the financially strapped and stressed out American middle is sounding fainter. You can join the conversation tonight. If you are old enough, can you feel the difference between middle-class America circa 1965 and the rich and the rest America of 2005? Is the old middle-class America now another country, a place we've left behind? Why? And can it live again? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. His article on the top tier of America's wealthy appeared in the paper on Sunday as part of a big Time series on class in America Today. David K. Johnston, wonderful to have you with us again. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, David.
David, give us the numbers. What's the case that the middle class has not got the standing in American society and American economy that it once had?
Well, the share of income going to the top tenth of 1% has more than doubled since the 1970s. It's now back up in the range that it was in the 1920s. The share of income going to people from the 90th step on the income ladder up to 99 has grown a little bit, and the share of the bottom 99% has declined. When you get down to the bottom third of Americans, they have a smaller piece of the pie today per person than they did back in 1970, even though the pie is enormously bigger. Per capita, it's more than 40% bigger than it was in 1970. So that we have these exploding incomes at the top, we have all these additional risks and uncertainties added to the middle class. There's research showing that even when people have two incomes, they face greater risks and uncertainties economically than they did 30 and 40 years ago. And at the bottom, we have people literally losing ground.
David, your colleague on the editorial page there at the Times, Paul Krugman, wrote today, looking back on the 1960s, he said, you know, it was a place where very few people were extremely wealthy, where many blue-collar workers earned wages that placed them comfortably in the middle class. Working families could expect steadily rising living standards and a reasonable degree of economic security. He writes, that was another country. The middle-class society I grew up in, this is Paul writing, no longer exists. Do the numbers bear that out?
Well, Paul's an editorialist. I'm a reporter.
Yes.
I think there is some positive to this, I mean, the fact is that overall American society is substantially richer than it was when I was growing up in the 50s and the 60s. It is the average size of new homes is much larger. But the gap, this gap, is just enormous and different. People, we did not have lots of people back then with their own jets in gated communities who created a whole separate environment for themselves. The sidebar that ran with my story, written by Geraldine Fabrikant, about the changes in Nantucket, I thought captured very well this change we're having.
The hyper-rich there. Jack Beattie, this gets in a way to the heart of things. I mean, the standard of living hasn't fallen, but it's not anywhere near the middle of the spectrum anymore. The top has just gone through the roof, and the middle hasn't followed.
No, and the top, in going through the roof, has taken government with it. The American Political Science Association, they put together a panel, and they made a sort of group statement about American politics today, and what they said was that the explosion of wealth in society has now been reflected in politics. Basically, they said government works for the wealthy and corporations. That is the reality of contemporary government. And so, yes, the rich are richer, but they're also converting it into subsidies, into preferments, into tax breaks, into, you know, through campaign contributions, they run the show.
We're going to look tonight at what that means for the country, for the economy, for your life, and for the health of the American democracy. You can join us if you're old enough. Can you feel the difference between middle-class America 1965 style and the rich and the rest America of 2005? Is the old middle-class America now another country, a country we've left behind? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David K. Johnston, Jack Beattie, stick with us. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the vanishing middle-class society and what it means for American democracy. You can join the conversation tonight, even if you weren't alive then, the 1960s, let's say. Can you imagine an America where there were very few super-rich, where blue-collar workers were comfortably middle-class, where ordinary families felt economically secure? Can you believe that America existed? And what does it mean for democracy when the strength of the middle class recedes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from New York by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times business reporter. Jack Beattie's with us. And right now from New Haven, Connecticut, we're joined by Jacob Hacker. He's assistant professor of political science at Yale University, author of the forthcoming book, The Great Risk Shift, The New Economic Insecurity and What Can Be Done About It. He teaches a course at Yale on inequality and American democracy. Jacob Hacker, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your bottom line analysis? I don't know if you read Paul Krugman today. Do you buy it? Is the middle-class America of the 60s a different country now? The middle class that emerged out of the Depression and World War II that saw broad swaths of equality and relative security, is that just history?
I think there's no question that there's been a major shift in the understanding of the middle class within our society and of the self-understanding of people within the middle class. And I don't think it's just that we know that high-income Americans have been pulling away over the last two decades. I think it's more centrally about the expectations that middle class Americans have today compared with those they had a generation ago. Expectations about job security, about their children having a better life than they had, about the security of their benefits at work and the security of their public benefits like Social Security. And more generally, I think their expectations about the role of democracy in terms of securing those benefits and making sure that all Americans can participate in the civic and consumer life of the nation.
When you look back on the middle class of the 60s, and you know, of course, most Americans still call themselves middle class, but you're suggesting it has a different meaning. What brought about that middle class in the sort of famous apogee, I guess, in the 60s? Was it an accident of American global economic supremacy? Was it deliberate policy?
It was both those things. And I think it's worth noting it goes back even farther. When the German socialist Werner Sombart looked at the absence of socialism in the United States in the early 20th century, he famously remarked that socialism in the United States had foundered on rafts of roast beef and apple pie, suggesting that the great material abundance of the middle class in the United States was one of the main reasons why socialist ideology hadn't taken root. But I think that, as you said, the apogee of the middle class reign came after World War II, and it was reflective of some distinctive circumstances. The United States was an unparalleled world power, not just in military terms as it is today, but on the economic stage. However, it also reflected some very deliberate government policies dating back really to the Great Depression. There was not only Social Security, unemployment insurance, and other programs designed to provide a modicum of economic security, but after the war, there was the GI Bill, which reached an enormous number of Americans, including African Americans, providing them with extended unemployment benefits, educational benefits, help buying a home. I think some 80% of males of the age to go to into service received benefits under the GI Bill. And through subsidized mortgages, through educational benefits, the United States really became a middle-class nation, and one in which the ideal was that you could go to work at the same employer for many years. There only had to be one earner within the household, and of course, it was usually the man. And you could expect that your children would enjoy a much higher standard of living than you did, and that you would enjoy a much higher standard of living than your parents had. It was really the American dream that we understand today. It was born out of the crucible of this post-war experience.
David K. Johnston, so we're in a different era now. The U.S. is not alone in a post-World War II world. It's a globalized economy. Does that mean that the gravy that was channeled to the middle class in those decades just isn't there to be shared anymore? Is the dream of that kind of middle class society impossible in a globalized economy?
I don't think it's at all impossible. It has to do with the decisions we've made about the rules in our society. You know, how the income is distributed in the society is not determined by God or some natural order. It is determined in large part by the rules of our society. The federal government is a fifth of our economy, so when it makes rules, by its very nature, it has a profound impact on them. Back 30 years ago, when more than a third of American workers belonged to unions, probably well more than two-thirds had wages affected by those unions. Employers paid to keep unions out or paid premium wages to get better quality workers. Lots of low-level management people effectively had their salaries set by that. That's one. Now we've had government policies that make it almost impossible to organize unions and don't punish companies that violate the rules. In making those changes, we've made decisions that have affected how income is distributed. The tax rules we have affect, over time, who has capital and who does not among people who have the opportunity to save and to invest. So the rules we make determine the kind of society that we have, and we have clearly had a set of rules that have been focused on further enriching those people who already are at the top of the game.
The impact of that is quite amazing in the numbers you point out on Sunday, David. You say from 1950 to 1970, for every additional dollar earned by the bottom 90%, that is the overwhelming majority.
Each person in the bottom 90%.
Yeah, those in the top 0.01% earned an additional $162. So, hey, you know, people at the top did much better than ordinary Americans. That is, for $1, $162 at the top. From 1990 to 2002, for every extra dollar earned by those in the bottom 90%, each taxpayer at the top brought in an extra $18,000. That is beyond an order of magnitude difference.
Well, yes, and Tom, let me point out that the second period is a shorter period, 12 years instead of 20, and it is after the stock market peaked. Because I didn't want anybody to accuse us, you know, of you picking 2000,
right, right. Mm-hmm.
The peak of the market. We very carefully tried to use those kind of numbers. We also show that over the first 15 years, this computer model at the Tax Policy Center, which the Treasury Department has a computer that could do this, but they haven't done it, or if they have, they won't give us the information. Mm. This computer model that the Bush administration acknowledges is reasonable and reliable says that 15% of the Bush tax cuts will go to one-tenth of 1% of the population.
So they go right to the top.
That's right.
Jacob Hacker, David K. Johnston quotes Alan Greenspan, certainly no raving liberal, looking at the portion of the nation's capital that is now in the hands of inheritors rather than strivers and innovators, people who've worked for it and earned it. And him saying in congressional testimony a year ago, Alan Greenspan, for the democratic society, that is not a very desirable thing to allow to happen. Why not?
Well, it really is important to recognize that the idea of democracy and the structure of a market economy can be quite compatible. But there are problems that occur when people can translate their economic resources into political resources. And that was always the fear of democratic theorists and popular politicians going back to the founding of the nation. You know, the estate tax is a legacy of a struggle that was fought by a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, who argued very strongly that there was real problems politically in the ability inherent in the ability of huge estates to be passed on from generation to generation, amassing great amounts of capital and power. And in essence, the problem is that although the Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal, we know that people differ greatly, not just in their knowledge about politics and their interest in it, but also in the amount of resources they can bring to bear on the political system. Now, the one big power that ordinary Americans have, regardless of their income or wealth, is the power of the vote. But in the last 20 years, campaign contributions have become much more important. And in turn, we've seen in the last few years a real decline in the competitiveness of many elections at the congressional level. And so there is real concern. It was expressed by the task force of the American Political Science Association that Jack Beatty mentioned and of which I was part, that there's a risk in the United States that the balance between free market and a well-functioning, thriving democracy could be tilting in a way that's unfavorable to middle-class Americans, unfavorable to Americans of lesser means, and could be self-reproducing. And that's really, I think, the big fear, is that if money allows people to influence policy in ways that increases their ability to gain resources and to amass capital, and that in turn allows them to have greater political influence, then the country could lose the sense of balance that democratic reformers tried to establish in putting some restrictions on the ability of people to translate their greater economic power into greater political power.
Jack Beatty, put this in some historical context for us. I remember growing up in the thick of the 60s that we're celebrating for its middle class profile tonight, traveling abroad, seeing vast inequalities in other countries, and feeling amazingly pleased that I came from a country where people weren't fearful of falling all the way into kind of the pit of poverty just at any moment, feeling how that gave America a kind of stability and gave individuals a sense of their weight in the society. Was that just a rare, weird moment in American history? Is it too much to imagine that going forward?
Well, when you look at the constituents of it, the autarkic economy, virtually the regulated economy, taxes on the top, I think 10% approached 75% now. What are they? 30? Perhaps even effective rate even lower. On and on and on. We're living after equality. We have had our innings of equality, I think, in this country. The conditions that led to it, the political conditions, domestic liberalism, that is definitely on the decline. The international economy, all the preconditions of the era of equality are gone. We're after equality. But, you know, if you'd come back to America 100 years earlier, say the America of 1870, after the Civil War, you'd have recognized a lot of what we're going through, and you would have seen it in the plight of the American farmer, who was the quintessential middle-class American. Steadily, from the Civil War onward, his income fell, his life chances contracted.
partly because of his immense productivity, partly because he was competing in a world economy for the first time, partly because the people who ran the government constrained the supply of money, and thus what he could get from his crops went down and down and down. And finally, and neither party was paying attention to him, finally he created his own social movement, the Populist Revolt and the Populist Party. They did not win, but they bequeathed to progressives, New Dealers, and 60s liberals a vocabulary of that actually overthrew the Jacksonian spell that government was the problem. That's what radicals had thought. They said, no, we need government to protect us. They introduced that whole idea into the 20th century, and reform movement after reform movement went back to the populists. Faced with downward mobility, faced with a crush of their hopes, they turned to reform.
You see that happening again, Jack? It certainly doesn't seem like the tenor of the country today. Big government is still the great bugaboo.
What frightens me is the other possibility, and that's the possibility of reaction. That's the possibility of turning further and further to a politics of division.
You mean reaction as opposed to reform?
Yes, to blame. In other words, who's to blame for this? Well, liberals are to blame. Government's to blame. Gays are to blame. Foreigners are to blame. Protectionism. That's what I fear. And we have seen that in history. It happened, in an accelerated way in Germany's brief experiment with democracy. And, for at least two decades now, people have been talking about what they call the Weimar parallel. That is the parallel between Weimar democracy and ours. That's a frightening thought.
Let's turn to our callers. Anthony's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Anthony, what do you think? What do you see?
Well, actually, it's not what I see. I'm just listening to the conversation. I think you guys are really getting in-depth analysis here. But I just want to offer a real-life situation here as far as my life.
Let's hear it.
I'm 32. I have two children. I have a toddler of two and an infant of 4 months. I'm happily married, and I've been, self-reflection. I look back in the last 4 or 5 years, okay?
Yes.
I've been blessed with an education, so, I'm a teacher, okay?
Yep.
So
right.
I've got $30,000, that I owe. I've paid my way through college,
okay?
And I'm going to be paying for a long time, okay? Second, I own a home, okay? I've been fortunate. The interest rates are low, and so there's great opportunities for a first home buyer. And when we talk about the federal government has given me an opportunity. They gave me 50% off the price of the house through HUD.
Tax breaks, right?
But I am just a small fraction. I've had the opportunity. I did the research, I'm still every week struggling with the bills. I mean, my when we talk about the hard costs and soft costs, yes. The food is affordable. Clothing is definitely affordable. You can get into it. Why are these things affordable? But then when we look at these other costs, with insurance, taxes.
So Anthony, let me ask: is middle class life working for you? Does it feel like what it ought to be in America?
No, it doesn't. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, I'm not complaining. I mean, this is the land of opportunity. But my point is, I give thanks to God. I mean, I'm not here. I'm not complaining. I'm definitely happy and I'm content with what I have. But the fact is that number one, I am in debt with student loans. But that's an investment. I mean, I realize
So there's this back and forth. We feel it. Our time is running short before the break, Anthony. But we thank you for your call, David K. Johnson. You hear right there this kind of ambivalence. I got my education in America. I've got my home in America. But Anthony says he's struggling and he doesn't feel like it's the right middle class deal. What do you hear in that?
Well, I hear a lot of people talking like that, and I hear a lot of this fear that both Jack and Jacob have talked about in our economy. People feel very uncertain. When I went to college in the 60s and the 70s, college was basically free. If it hadn't been, I wouldn't have been able to go. And now we impose these huge barriers to the investments we should be making in human capital for the future. Lots of people cannot go into occupations they want to go into, police officer, firefighter, nurse, that are essential to making our society run because of this focus on the top rather than on what kind of society that we want to have. Years ago, Edward Luttbach, one of those people who was paid to think about the unthinkable, nuclear war, wrote an essay in which he observed that if we could raise the GDP in this country one percentage point, but the cost was a bunch of additional murders and it would be unsafe for him to go from his building to a car at the curb, would it be worth it? And we need to sort of talk about that. We need to talk about there are trade-offs that go on in our society. Do we want to enable the wealthiest people in America to pay taxes at the same rate as people who make $50,000 to $75,000 or $100,000 a year, as we showed in the Times on Sunday, so that the wealthiest people can have private jets?
And
if that's a social good, let's debate it.
Right there is a matter of priorities. Who's going to live? How? David K. Johnston, Jacob Hacker, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the vanishing middle class society. What do you think? Has political power followed the money to the top tier? And most Americans still call themselves middle class, but does that mean real security or power today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the vanishing middle class society and what it means for American democracy. We're joined tonight from New Haven, Connecticut, by Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale, author of the forthcoming book, The Great Risk Shift. From New York, by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. Jack Beatty's with us. You can join us as well. In a competitive, globalized economy, is a robust, healthy middle class too much to hope for? Is it more than we can sustain? Or is having a healthy middle class a choice we can make? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gil is calling from Black River Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Gil. You're on the air.
Hey, how y'all doing tonight?
We're good. What do you think, Gil?
Pretty good. I'm doing good. I'm going to condense this to like three quick points. I've been listening to what you're all saying.
Yeah.
And your screener asked me, is it different? Middle class, different than...
What do you think? What do you think?
Oh, yeah, it's way different. I'll agree with Anthony. I'm 44, and my mom raised a single, as a single mom, raised five kids. I'm working way more than my mom and stepdad ever did, combined. And so it has changed. And as I've been listening to the ideals that are coming out, I'll leave it to the learned people to really make up the solutions. But just briefly, number one, when it comes to socialism and the rich class, you know, the rich are getting richer, poor getting poorer, middle class getting squeezed. The way to overcome that is by the vote. Because when the middle class stand up with their votes, that will overcome all the special interests and all the money getting piped into Washington.
But why hasn't that happened in these last 20 years in general, Gil?
Well, because, at least in my experience, is one of your guests hit it on the nail head, at least to a certain degree. The poorer class or the lower class, the lower income people, they get a lot of subsidies nowadays, which is work in itself, believe it or not. You have to give your whole life story. You're always at a government office somewhere, and you're afraid that they'll pull the plug on you, so you just accept what they give you and try to make that substitute somewhat of your income. The middle class, I believe, are just too tired. I work 65 to 70 hours a week to raise my kids, and most of my kids are of adult age now. I got one 14-year-old left.
That's a lot of hours, more hours than leave you time to have the energy to kind of stand up. Gil, thanks for calling. Jacob Hacker, what do you think? A middle class too tired to stand up and reassert itself in the American economy and in the American political system, or has the middle class made its own honest choice here? It's saying, no, we want that great headroom for the rich because we may be rich ourselves one day.
Well, I don't think that either that everyone who considers themselves middle class feels the same way about that question, or that people have necessarily are unconflicted about it. Mm. You know, America is made up of contrasting strains of thought, and I think most people feel at one and the same time that this is a land of opportunity and that people should rise and fall on their own, and that when other people fall on bad times, hard times through no fault of their own, that we should come to their aid. So I think that in some ways the most powerful challenge to the ideal of middle class family life that exists today is really the rise in economic insecurity and anxiety that Americans feel. It's not the numbers about the rise at the top. It's what people are feeling in their everyday lives. And let me just give a couple quick examples. Mm. One is that a survey that Alan Greenspan actually uses looks at how secure people feel about their job. And during the early 1980s, roughly 20% of Americans said they feared losing their job, according to the survey. By the late 1990s, when the economy was actually roaring, around 60% of Americans said they feared losing their job. Another example is the rise in the number of people who don't have health insurance, or the shift away from traditional pensions that provide a guaranteed benefit in retirement to 401k plans that are like investment accounts that that you bear the risk of downside drops in. So it seems to me that we've moved away from the idea that we're in this together, and people are conflicted about how they should feel about that. And so Anthony's comment, I think, really reflects how a lot of people feel. That is, they're not going to complain. They're working hard. They are trying to play by the rules and do right by their families. It's a story of private heroism, if you will. But at the same time, they feel like something's amiss and adrift, that there's a need for some kind of common protections that would be there, you know, if the bottom fell out.
But let me ask you about that, because, of course, the answer to that is often globalization makes that impossible, that there are forces that sort of preordain a new financial order, and we're just going to have to deal with it. You write that it's within the power of political and corporate leaders to deal with these new intensified risks, but how do you really do that?
It's certainly within the power to deal with them, and I think that the biggest mistake is to say that this is beyond the control of political leaders or policymakers. There certainly are broader forces that are increasing the instability of family life, and some of these cannot be addressed directly. But there's no question that we could fashion better supports for dealing with some of the dislocations that Americans are facing. And let me just suggest two simple examples. We know that our healthcare system is a mess, that we have the best healthcare in the world and the worst health insurance system. Mm. We have 45 million Americans without insurance. We have one-third of non-elderly Americans going without insurance at some point over a two-year period. There are a lot of ideas on the table. Many of them would involve highly private means of expanding coverage. But we know that people would feel more secure in their workplace, would be more likely to get necessary care, would be more likely.
And it's not happening.
And it's not happening. And another example, just as simple in its broad conception, is we know that our pension system has created a great deal of uncertainty for Americans. 401k plans have a lot of virtues, but they're voluntary at the place of your work, and they put a lot of risk on the worker.
And pensions dropping like flies at United and everywhere else.
And so I think there are a lot of ideas on the table for how to improve the regulation of pension plans, or simply to provide some kind of government backstop. And what I want to make clear, and I think it's something that David K. Johnson pointed out, and it's quite right, is that if people feel that when they invest in education and building a family and new jobs, that they are going to bear all the risk if things go sour, they're going to be a lot less likely to make those investments up front. So ultimately, a middle class that's afraid is not a middle class that's building up a strong and stable civic and economic life.
Or maybe that's really
for all Americans.
Maybe that's really contributing in its best way to democracy itself. Linda's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi. Great show. I just wanted to give a comparison of the financial situation of my family when I was growing up in a one-income household and my situation now in a two-income household. And when I was growing up, my dad was a piano teacher and then later a piano tuner.
Okay.
And had a small business. and we never worried about the big ticket items. We always had a home. We knew we would get a college education and all of those things. And also, we had a lot of time on our hands. We did a lot of things as a family. We were boating, skiing, and...
And that's a one-income household of a piano tuner and teacher.
Yep.
And now?
And now, the level of stress is just constant. And I feel like one bad situation could cause us to lose our home or lose our health care.
Are both you and your husband working now?
Yes. We both work full-time. We're both highly educated. And I just see a huge difference in quality of life.
Two incomes, a lot of education, and a lot of stress. Linda, thanks for sharing your story. David K. Johnson, I know we just have you for another minute here. What we understand from Washington lately is that if the country moves to rein in the rich, it leaves everyone poorer, worse off, and maybe even less secure. Does that add up?
Well, here's the question I think we ought to ask ourselves. How is it that the Swedes, after paying all those taxes, seem to be doing so well, and the richest man in the world today is a Swede? Maybe the way we spend our taxes, what we spend our taxes on, has a significant impact on the costs. And to the extent that we have decided as a matter of public policy to push down incomes at the bottom and have the average American family now with children works 5.5 months more paid labor than they did in 1970. To think that having a parent out of the house for that much more time will not have an impact, it may be mitigatable, it may not be bad, but to think it doesn't have an impact I think is unrealistic. So I think we have to look at the costs and the benefits of what's happening. Now, if you were to take, in an extreme example, 99% of the income and funnel it to 1% of the people in the country, I think we'd all agree that you would not have a stable, productive society. So what we ought to be debating is how is it that the government's rules are affecting this distribution of income? We want people who want to work hard to be able to succeed. We need to have capital for investments. But have the rules been rewritten? Do we have a society, a government now, of the rich, by the rich, for the rich, elected by the unrich, who don't understand what's happening?
And when I read the title of your book, David, The Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everyone Else, I guess you've made your decision about what's going on.
Yeah, and I have another book coming on it soon.
David K. Johnson, I know you've got a flight to catch. We're very grateful to you for joining us tonight. Thanks for all your work. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Kristen is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Kristen, what do you think? What's going on?
Well, the point I wanted to make was I think our expectations, or our definition, I should say, of the middle class has changed over the years. So I was born in 1963,
yep.
And my family was definitely part of the middle class. But we had a two-bedroom, one-bath, one-car garage home, and my sister and I shared a room, and that was very common amongst all my friends. And now I think, and yes, it was a one-income situation, and we didn't have the stress, and we had the free time. But also we may do. We didn't have, you know, we didn't feel the need for the $30,000 or $40,000 new car or two new cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my parents shared a car. We had, you know, probably a 13-inch black and white TV. Now, granted, TV was still relatively new at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, I mean, you can go out and find a TV for $15,000-$20,000, which is just amazing to me. And I think people are much more willing to live beyond their means. So dare I say it, I think there's perhaps a little more entitlement, you know, that people feel that, okay, I'm middle class, that means I must have a four-bedroom, you know, two baths, two or three-car garage home,
right,
and two SUVs.
So maybe people just expecting too much. Let us look at that. And thanks, Kristen, for your call. Jacob Hacker, how about it? Has the middle class itself just gotten too greedy?
Well, there certainly is anecdotal evidence to suggest that. You know, people do have bigger houses than they did 30 years ago, although not as much bigger as you might think, because we always look at the statistics on the size of new homes, but in fact, most people don't live in new homes.
Right.
But I think that the size of homes in which people are living has gone up, and certainly housing has gotten much more expensive. But some careful analyses that have been done suggest to me that that although this may be a part of the story, a sort of luxury fever, and I think it's consistent, by the way, with the argument that David K. Johnson and others have made about the super rich. I mean, we're keeping up with a much richer Joneses than we used to. If we want to have some of the trappings of affluence as middle class families have aspired to in the past, then we spend a lot more money. But the study suggests to me that the big expenses, health care, housing, education, are really what's driving much of the squeeze that middle class families are feeling. And I would just want to emphasize again the fact that families are also facing a lot more income uncertainty and volatility, a lot more churning of their income from year to year, and that independent of their spending level, is a very important a factor that's making people feel less secure. So I think what's going on is that it is true there's a lag. I mean, people, I think, expect that they should have the fruits of this economy if they are making between, say, $40,000 and $80,000 a year, and it's very hard to do that in many cases. But I also think that it's just much harder than it once was. There's a time bind, there's a debt bind, and there's a risk bind that's meaning that people are facing a lot more anxiety about maintaining that level of that standard of living. And ultimately, I do think that that has real implications for our political life, because it really is the case that if Americans are feeling that the political system is not responding to the pressures they're feeling in their own life, that they're going to, I think, either turn inward or turn to solutions that are either counterproductive or actually dangerous. And so to me, it's important for maintaining our healthy democratic life that our political leaders are responding and recognizing the strains that average Americans are facing. And I just feel that at the moment, that's not the case.
Jack Beatty, maybe I'm just a prisoner of the time I grew up in, but I feel a whole lot more confident in our country when there's a very healthy middle class that's not stressed out and too tired to stand up and too tired to vote. I feel a lot more confident in the future when that big middle is kind of large and in charge.
Yes, and growing and confident. You know, the question was earlier, and I think it's at the center of this, why haven't things changed? It's been going on now for 30 years. Why no change? Why politics hasn't responded? Well, you can find some clue to that in the 19th century. That is, people were divided in the 19th century. The northern politics was all about waving the bloody shirt. That is, saying, my gosh, if you vote for the Democratic Party, you're voting for people who shot at you during the Civil War. And this kind of polarization, these cultural issues, divided farmers in the north from farmers in the south way after the Civil War. And effectively, it was a divide-and-rule situation. The oligarchy could rule because the people were at each other's throats through these cultural issues, very like today, where there are strong cultural and moral issues that divide the country and that polarize it. And I often think that these issues are almost sort of implanted by elites. Yes, they're there, but they're so elite-led, because when you look at the broad consensus in the country on almost all issues, even moral issues, roughly, it's like, wait a minute, why can't we have that middle sort of government that seems to be indicated by this data?
Well, here's wishing good health and good wealth to the big middle of the country and everybody else. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Jacob Hacker at Yale, author of the forthcoming The Great Risk Shift, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.